You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hey, I'm Alicia Menendez of HuffPost Live, and today for Leonard Lopate. The nature versus nurture debate is age old. Are we, in the words of Lady Gaga, born this way, or are we products of our environment? With the help of genetics research, scientists have increasingly attributed human behavior to nature, suggesting that much of who we are is ultimately based on biology. Jesse Prinz challenges this notion in his latest book, Beyond Human Nature, How Culture and Experience Shape the Human Mind. Ranging from emotions to values to language, Mr. Prinz argues that our surroundings play a greater role in shaping us than is often acknowledged. Jesse Prinz is a distinguished professor of philosophy and director of the Committee for Interdisciplinary Science Studies at the City University of New York Graduate Center. His book is published by Norton. I am pleased to welcome him to our show. Great to see you.
It's delightful to be here, Alicia.
So in the nature versus nurture debate today, which side's winning?
Well, I think everyone will tell you it's both. But I think what we've seen in a lot of the publishing on the nature-nurture debate is people love biology. They love to think that who they are has to do with their biological makeup. But I think if you look at the science, it really looks like nurture has a big hand, maybe a much bigger hand than we've thought. And it's important to realize that because I think what's special about human beings, what separates us from all other creatures, is the extent to which our behavior can be shaped by our upbringing and by our cultural environment.
Do you think we prefer this biology argument because it gives us a pass?
I think it does. I think it gives us also a sense of authenticity. So take the debate about sexuality, and you might say, okay, well, my sexual preference is part of my biology, therefore it's part of me. It's not simply something I learned. It's part of who I am, essentially. And that gives people a sense of ownership. But I think what we need to realize is that whether it comes from biology or environment or biography, it really doesn't matter. It's always going to be part of you. It's part of your identity, and it's always going to be informed by the world that you live in.
So this used to be an argument for philosophers. How successful have neuroscientists and psychologists been answering questions about human nature?
Well, I think the training of a neuroscientist or of a psychologist leads to a bias towards the nature side of the debate. If you read a psych textbook, there's no warning on the title page saying this is anthropology, like we're doing the psychology of American college students. But that's what they're doing. Right. And if you run the very same experiments on other cultural samples, you see different results. So everything we take as the model of how the mind works is actually how the mind of the people who are in the study work. Now, psychology and neuroscience turn out to be extremely useful tools for studying cultural comparisons. They just haven't done a lot of that. And really what the book is about is it's an effort to survey a recent initiative across the social sciences to really study cultural difference in a meaningful way.
So do you have an answer on this nature versus nurture question?
I guess I'm a nurture guy. I mean, Gaga's a great case, right? She's somebody who's extremely flamboyant. Her whole self-presentational style, the kind of music she makes, all of that could only happen here and now. She is not a product of genes for Gaga.
I don't know. Her mother might beg to differ. Now, if you're correct that human nature is mostly influenced by culture, does that mean we're in a better position to make positive societal changes?
Well, I think that the opportunity for human change through socialization is enormous, and we've seen that. So, for example, the amount of violence we see in the world today is far lower, at least certain kinds of violence like homicide, than has been true in past centuries. And I think if you look at movements of liberation like the women's movement, people who have been told they simply cannot excel in certain fields like law and medicine are now occupying more than half of the positions, entry positions in those fields. So human plasticity is one of the greatest sources of human progress.
Take that, Larry Summers. Women good at math and science.
There
you
go.
You know, we say this is an age-old conversation, but when did this conversation about nature versus nurture really start?
Well, it is age-old in some sense, but you really see it picking up in the 19th century. So a cousin of Charles Darwin, who some of you may have heard of, a guy named Francis Galton, wrote these books arguing that human behavior is really a function of biology. And he coined a term called eugenics. And eugenics was the science of good breeding. The word means good breeding. And it led to all kinds of programs like mandatory sterilization that tried to get rid of the bad genes, which were blamed for poverty, and promote the good genes. And of course, this is a very sinister history. It contributed to the thinking of the Third Reich and the Second World War, among other catastrophes. And I think it was really in the context of 19th century biological thinking about behavior that people got very interested in trying to settle this question scientifically. What can we learn from science about whether human behavior is societal or biological?
You know, we have thinkers like Hobbes who conclude that humans are selfish and belligerent, while Rousseau came to the exact opposite conclusion. How does that happen?
Well, I think these guys are products of their time. So Hobbes was writing at a time of tremendous violence in Europe. The world had been occupied by war, by the 30 Years' War. He's exposed to all of that. And in that social setting, you're going to see people as belligerent. They are. The societal conditions have led to absolute warfare, of war of all against all, as he put it. And it's only with strong sovereignty, strong government, monarchy, in other words, that these wars were able to be settled. And I think for someone like Rousseau, who's writing a bit later in the time of the French Revolution and the Enlightenment, where you see a move towards democratization, the idea that human beings can get along with each other even in the absence of a great monarch. In fact, the French monarch had been brought down at this point because of corruption. That's a very credible view. So people are deciding what humans are like in general based on what people in their current societies are like. But that's really a function of history.
I am Alicia Menendez of HuffPost Live. In today for Leonard Lopate, our guest is Jesse Prinz. His new book, Beyond Human Nature, How Culture and Experience Shape the Human Mind, is out by Norton. So focusing on biology for a second, what can we tell about a person's behavior just by looking at their DNA?
Well, I think what you get with DNA is some kind of predictive value, but very modest predictive value.
So predictive value, what does that mean?
So suppose you know that somebody is the child of an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. You can look at statistics, and it turns out, depending on the study, that maybe about 15% of children of addicts have problems with addiction themselves. Now, 5% of kids who are not children of addicts have problems with addiction. Mm-hmm. So you show that being the child of an addict is not at all necessary. You can be an addict without having an addict parent or addictive genes. But, you know, it's a little bit more likely that you'll be an addict. Not that much more likely. And, of course, you get a much bigger percentage, 85% are not addicts. So it's certainly not destiny. But if you know that you are coming from a background of addiction, there's that small difference, maybe 10% more likelihood that you're going to be susceptible to addiction. And that might lead you to shape your behavior in ways that are going to take that into consideration. But social factors like living in a low-income situation might be much bigger predictors for addiction. So knowing those societal factors is going to be even more important in making those life decisions.
So what does it mean to inherit something genetically?
Well, the term heritability is a very misleading term, because what heritability is used for in the science is to measure how much variance in a population correlates with biological relatedness. So basically what you do is you take a bunch of twins and a bunch of siblings who are not twins, and you see whether the similarity between the twins is greater than the similarity between the non-twins, and you get a number that we call heritability. That's one way to do it. That term makes it sound like these traits are biologically inherited. But in fact, heritability is very relative to the particular sample, the particular group of people you're looking at. Suppose they all have exactly the same environment. They're raised in very homogeneous social settings. Maybe they're all, say, middle-class Americans. Then you're going to get a fairly high heritability rating for some traits, like personality traits or intelligence, because you're keeping environment fixed. But suppose you're looking at people in very different environments. Then if you did the very same study, the heritability numbers would plummet. They'd go down to near the floor. And what that suggests is that this notion of what's inherited is always relative to environment. How much am I going to get from my parents' genes? It depends on whether I'm in an environment that's having a big impact or an environment that's fairly constant and stable, unlikely to have a big impact.
I'm at that age where all of my friends are deciding to have kids or having kids, and there seem to be sort of infinite conversations about, oh no, which of my terrible traits are they going to inherit? Should we be talking instead about where should I raise them? What's the environment I'm going to raise them in?
Absolutely. Obviously, there are things like heritable diseases where we're screening is done. But I think environment is really key. And parents, you know, have often had this tremendous guilt trip about the way that their kids have come out. And some of that guilt is biological. They say, oh, no, they got all my bad traits. The truth of the matter is kids are much more influenced by their peer group than by their parents. And if you look at, you know, say, basic core values, like what are your politics? Now, this is something that's very important to us. We say, I'm a liberal or I'm a conservative. That's part of our identity. That's going to depend on what town you grow up in. So if you really want to have an impact on your kids' values or your kids' behavior, it's going to be very important to put them in a social setting where their peers are going to have the kinds of values and the kinds of abilities you want them to have.
Or you end up with a Michael P. Keaton.
Or you end up with Michael P. Keaton.
So are there specific genes that determine most traits?
If the term of a gene for X, a gene for alcoholism, for instance, or for that matter, a gene for homosexuality, is, I think, absolutely misleading. It's very, very bad biology. And the reason for that is, first of all, you can have the trait without one of these genes. So once we identify these genes, it's not true that having that gene is necessary for the trait. But also, the majority of people who have the gene for alcoholism, or there's recently been a so-called warrior gene, a gene for violence, the majority of people who have that gene don't show the trait. So merely having a specific gene is not going to be necessary or sufficient for having a certain trait. Genes work in a very complex way in interaction with other genes. What genes really code for is different kinds of proteins, different bits of physical matter that appear in the body at different times. It's always in interaction with the whole genetic environment and especially with the external environment that a trait gets determined.
How about obesity?
Well, I think obesity, any of these, we can talk about genes that are involved in behavior, and those are genes that are connected to psychological traits. In a certain way, I think we should expect a greater link between genes and physical traits than the link between genes and psychological traits. And the reason for that is simple, or actually it's complex. It's the complexity of the brain. The brain has 100 billion neurons. Each of them has thousands of connections to other neurons. There's no way something as simple as the genome could code for every connection in the brain. So basically, the genome is thrifty. It's a very, very economical way of trying to create a complex organism. And the way it creates a sophisticated human brain is by creating a learning machine, by creating this system that isn't pre-wired, that doesn't come connected at the start, but exposes itself to experience in a way that allows the educational environment, the social environment, to shape our behavioral capacities. But biological traits having to do with the physical body might be different. So how tall you are or how heavy you are, those things might be closer to genes. But even there, and this is important, biology interacts with the environment. So height. Human height has been dramatically increasing over the generations. You look at doorways and houses from the last century, and they're shorter. Why is that? Diet. You look at height in East Asia, where dairy has been injected into the diet since the Second World War, and average height has grown dramatically over the space of a generation or two.
Early onset of puberty.
Early onset of puberty is another huge case, major phenomenon right now, and clearly there's a change in our environment. Obesity too. Obesity is a fairly new phenomenon in its prevalence, and in the U.S. we see much more incidence of obesity than in other countries. New statistics suggest that American health is much lower than countries with equal economic standing, and I think it's clear that there's something about our diet, there's something about our habits that are leading to a greater probability of these behavioral outcomes.
If you are not following us on Facebook, you ought to be. Vanessa left this comment. Siblings can be so different in personality, intelligence, talents, etc., yet grow up in the same house with similar experiences and have the same parents. It seems as though both play a huge role, but I'd vote for experiences as the more powerful influence. All right. Well, you got one vote there.
Yeah, good. And but of course, that's a nicely nuanced position because it says, look, there are these differences. You can have two kids with the same environment to come out differently. And a lot of people see that and say, oh, that must be biology at work. And of course, biology is going to tell part of the story. But we need to realize, though, is that two siblings who are raised in the same household don't have the same experience. The very fact that they're siblings forces differentiation. They want to distinguish themselves from their sibling. They're being raised by parents who have had more experience in the case of second siblings, who are the second sibling is dealing with an older sibling who might be more vocal. They might be trying to get the affection of the second sibling. And, of course, their biographical experiences, their peers, their school experiences, all of those will be very, very different.
And sure enough, Marion on Facebook says, as one of eight kids, I'm going for experiences. Well, I'm speaking with Jesse J. Prinz. He's a distinguished professor of philosophy and director of the Committee for Interdisciplinary Science Studies at the City University of New York Graduate Center. His latest book is called Beyond Human Nature, How Culture and Experience Shape the Human Mind. It's published by W.W. Norton & Company, and we'll have more after a break. Later on in the show, Massimo Montanari on his new book, Let the Meatballs Rest, about food culture, food lore, cooking methods, and eating habits throughout history. Plus, Dina Kay talks about the centenary celebration of her father, the award-winning entertainer Danny Kay. I'm Alicia Menendez of HuffPost Live, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by Penguin Books, publisher of All There Is, edited by Dave Isay. This essay collection from StoryCorps explores unexpected places where love is found and relationships begin, including a New York toll booth, a military base in Iraq, and an airport lounge. Available now wherever books are sold. The New School, partnering with the Municipal Arts Society to host Charting the Road to Resilience, a day-long event to share lessons learned from Hurricane Sandy, Saturday, January 12th. Information at newschool.edu/events. WNYC is a media partner of Sinfonietta of Riverdale's presentation of All Jazzed Up, featuring works by composer Kurt Vile and Christopher Byers, January 13th at the Riverdale Temple. Details at sinfonietta.nyc.org.
This week on Radiolab, the battle between good,
it's like a fountain of youth, Gene,
and evil.
Silence!
That happens inside our genes.
These genes are struggling with each other.
But what if we could rig the fight? Could we live forever?
It sort of reopens the quest for the fountain of youth in a new molecular way. Used to be people would talk about that, but it's the world of fairy tales and fantasy. And now...
Thursday nights at 8 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
I'm Alicia Menendez of HuffPost Live. In today for Leonard Lopate, our guest, Jesse Prinz, is the author of Beyond Human Nature, How Culture and Experience Shape the Human Mind. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. So, Jesse, there are five main personality traits that psychologists study. What are those five?
Well, the way students remember it is with the acronym OCEAN. So one of them is it's actually five dimensions. So the first one is openness to new experience, and its opposite is being closed to new experience. The second one is conscientiousness, which has to do with things like whether you're tidy and organized or live more chaotically. The next one is extroversion, which contrasts with introversion. The next one after that is agreeableness, how friendly or affable you are, or the opposite. And the final one is neuroticism. So somebody who is very neurotic would be contrasted with somebody who's very emotionally level.
Why those five?
Well, it's not the case that these are the only personality traits. There are many, many. It just so happens that research has shown these to be particularly robust. So if you're doing a study that says, is this trait real? Are the person's perceptions of their own trait going to match up with public perceptions of their trait? Is the trait going to stick around for a while? Is it going to have an impact on behavior? These traits turn out to be the ones that have proven the most reliable for doing the science.
And how can they tell how much each trait is based on biology?
Well, they do it using the method I described before, usually. So they'll do, say, a twin study where they say, are identical twins more similar with respect to this trait than mere siblings?
What would we do without these identical twins?
Well, the twins have been hugely useful for the science, but you actually don't need them because you could look at siblings versus non-siblings. So any comparison group where you have some pairs who are more related than others allows you to look for relatedness as a variable. How much is relatedness going to predict whether people have the trait? And what you see with these traits is you get between like a 0.3 and a 0.5 heritability rating, which roughly means that if you're looking at a group of people, the amount of variation in that group can be explained or correlated with biological relatedness to about 30 to 50%. But it's, again, a very, very misleading number because these are cases usually, even with twins separated at birth, of people who are raised in social environments that are pretty similar. They're raised in the same income bracket, for instance, and they're raised in the same culture, usually the same region. So it's not just Americans. It might be suburban, you know, Americans in Minnesota. And because of that, we really don't have a good way of studying or haven't taken upon ourselves to study the impact of really significant cultural differences. So suppose you took people who were related but lived in extremely different environments. They lived in two different countries. What would happen with heritability? We know that if you look at poverty, that is, you look at people who are in low socioeconomic groups and look at a trait like intelligence, heritability drops down to 0.1 instead of 0.5. And my guess is you'd see the same thing with personality. As soon as you make the environment more unstable, less secure, or more culturally varied, the contribution of biology is going to diminish to something very insignificant.
You threw out that great acronym OCEAN with the N going to neuroticism. Are there any personality traits correlated with living in New York?
It's a wonderful question. I don't know about whether the OCEAN traits are correlated with living in New York. There is some work on moral behavior, and so it does turn out that people vary in their degree of niceness across cities. And having lived through the recent storm here, Sandy, I was struck by human niceness. I mean, New Yorkers were absolutely fabulous.
Yep.
But if you look at the science, it's a bit more of a mixed verdict.
But so, neurotic. I mean, I made everyone get away from their windows because I was sure they were going to come crashing
New
in.
New Yorkers are definitely neurotic. I can tell you that from very personal experience, or I can testify about myself. If you look at, say, niceness is measured by, would you help a stranger who dropped a pen or dropped an object on the street? Would you help pick them up? It turns out that the nicest people in the world are in Rio de Janeiro. So Brazilians are super nice. They'll just help a stranger with a simple act like picking up an object that's fallen on the street. New Yorkers are sort of in the middle of the spectrum. So I do think that when we start to look at in this case, cases of moral personality, we can see that the city you live in can have some impact on how you act.
Dan in Park Slope left this comment on our show page. You can do the same by going to WNYC.org. What would the author have to say about the behavioral predisposition of dog breeds? We have bred behaviors into different dogs over the centuries, demonstrating that some could have more honed instincts for attacking, protecting, sniffing drugs, retrieving animals. Goes on and on. Doesn't that demonstrate a large amount of genetic influence on our behavior?
Well, I mean, I think there's a danger of comparing us to dogs. Obviously, there are similarities too. Dogs, you know, I mean, they're more subject to very active breeding for traits than any other creature on Earth, with the possible exception of some lab mice and fruit flies created for science. These are animals that have been basically tailor-made for certain human purposes. They're more like tools, like hammers or screwdrivers, mm-hmm. than like naturally occurring organisms. But the main thing, you know, suppose it hadn't been dogs but had been some wild animal. I think with human beings, we need to appreciate that our success story, the fact that we are so different from other creatures, stems entirely from our plasticity, our capacity for learning. The fact that each generation knows stuff that the previous generation didn't know, that's unique to us. The fact that we live in houses and wear clothes, that's unique to us. The fact that we've created languages and these systems of communication, all this stuff is so different. And it really means that whatever we get, whatever variants we get as a function of our biology, suppose our starting position was like dogs and some of us were just, you know, barkier than others, all of that can still be changed because it's central to the human story that we have this ability to change our initial hand and end up with something very, very different.
It seems to be a mainstream idea that intelligence is genetic. How does intelligence differ from other traits?
Well, I think intelligence is just like other traits in the sense that I think for every trait, what we see is doing the science in a certain way will lead to an impression that biology is making a contribution, and it does. But where it typically is having its impact might be on the real extreme. So there are people with profound disabilities that might impact their degree of potential for educational achievement. On the other hand, if we look at the vast majority of us, if we look at the people who are sort of average IQ, their variance really has very little to do with biology. So if you look at, say, a 10-point spread around 100 points, which is the IQ average in this country, we can see movement of 10 points in IQ simply as a function of 4 years of college education. We can see movement in the equivalent of IQ tests, which which are like GRE scores or SAT scores, simply by taking a training course. So I think that it's really, really crucial to realize that if we're interested in differences in intelligence, the thing we should be interested in is learning and culture.
How do you think someone like Ayn Rand, who believes in survival of the fittest, would respond to what you're saying?
Well, Ayn Rand is a really interesting case because she's very much of a product of a certain kind of extreme capitalist vision. I mean, she's somebody who believed in the power of the individual, and she thought that some individuals have greater capacity than others. But I think even if you are enamored with that system, you don't need to buy into this idea of biological difference. In fact, this whole idea of attainment through individual effort could be worked into a quasi-Randian story. I wouldn't recommend it, but just imagine that everybody starts on an even playing field and you're all let out to try and compete. So some people will try different training regimens and they'll end up doing better than others, but you'll still get this kind of dog-eat-dog, to go back to our canine friends, world where some people are able to achieve more.
I'm Alicia Menendez in today for Leonard Lopate. Our guest is Jesse Prinz, the author of Beyond Human Nature, How Culture and Experience Shape the Human Mind. That's out by Norton. You're listening to WNYC and WNYC.org. So, Jesse, where does the idea of an IQ or an intelligence quotient come from?
Well, it's a 19th century or turn of the 20th century idea. And there was a really under the influence of Galton, who was very interested in biological origins of genius. It became a standard thing to try and test people for some quantity of intellectual ability that could be measured across the whole population. And it was put to very dubious purposes. So, for example, by making generalizations about certain populations, there were quotas put on immigration. So you wouldn't let certain people into the country because they would bring down the gene pool by bringing in these dumb genes. And pretty much every group we've seen that have been denigrated as having biologically lower IQ have turned out to come up to back to the average range if they've been put in equal conditions vis-a-vis education. So I think IQ was part of a vision that was really cultivated in the 19th century that tried to explain difference biologically. Galton himself was obsessed with poverty. So in England, there is this rise of the Industrial Revolution, and you have this very beleaguered working class, and they're miserable. And he says, why are these people not achieving what I've achieved? And of course, he came from a very affluent and well-connected family. So he, instead of going to the obvious, we were born with a silver spoon in our mouth, he said maybe they're biologically inferior. Capitalism gave rise to this dream of upward mobility. And when you see the underclass stuck at the bottom, that is a somewhat appealing explanation, especially if you're looking down from the top.
It's a meme that persists today. A listener on Twitter says, as a twin, people assume our similarities are all due to DNA. I can definitely say that most of ours are due to environment. Thanks. If you are not following us on Twitter, you can follow us at Leonard Lopate. Be sure to send us your comments and your questions. So when we measure IQ, what are we even measuring?
Well, IQ, you can think of it as a kind of statistical artifact. So one way to get at it is give somebody 10 different tests. They can be different kinds of tests. One could be a math test. It could be a test in vocabulary, a test in geometrical reasoning. And then you just align them. You put them together. And you say, okay, well, there's some people who score well on all three of these. So let's call that IQ because it's a general intelligence. That is, it's the thing that is going to show strong abilities in three different intellectual domains. But if you think about that for a minute, it's a kind of cheat. It's just going to be a kind of coincidence that some people happen to be good in three kinds of tests. Maybe not a complete coincidence. Maybe they went to prep school, or maybe there's something about their level of motivation that leads them to try and excel in everything they ever get their hands on. But the idea that there is some like cognitive mechanism that's the same for these very different domains is really implausible. In fact, these domains can be selectively impaired through brain damage. You can knock one out and the others remain intact. So I think what we really do tend to find is that by treating achievement across multiple domains as a single construct, we sort of invent a thing that isn't really there.
You talk a lot about where thinking comes from. You write a lot about it. What are I and we cultures?
So it's a little bit of a generalization because we end up in talking about I and we cultures, focusing on research that's distinguished the West, like Western Europe and the United States, and the Far East. So a lot of work has been done in China, Korea, and Japan. And even before broaching the topic, it's very important to realize that there's a huge amount of diversity within the Western cultures and within Far Eastern cultures. There's much more diversity within these cultures than across them. But If you average across Eastern samples and Western samples, you tend to see in the West a very strong emphasis on what's called individualism. So this is the idea that individual achievement is the most fundamental value and that individuals achieve what they do because they're independent or autonomous. They do it on their own. And in the Far East, there's a greater emphasis on basically social dependency. So the fact that you're part of a social group, your identity comes from a social collective, and that your worth in life depends on contributing to the ends of that social collective. So we end up with very different value systems that emphasize what can I do on my own in the I cultures and what can we do as a group in the we cultures. And what's been so exciting for psychologists is that it turns out that that difference in values, do I care more about myself or the group, translates into differences in perception and cognition. So people in I cultures and we cultures literally see the world differently.
You also addressed gender in your chapter about thought. How was women's ability to think characterized by scientists in the 19th century?
Well, the 19th century had a very unflattering view about women, to put it lightly.
One could argue the 20th century was not much kinder. But
The 20th century has not been much kinder. And in fact, a lot of what we see today in terms of the ongoing fight for equality reflects that legacy. But, of course, in the 19th century, women were effectively slaves. They were male property, and their lives were largely restricted to domestic servitude. And of course, their access to education was extremely limited. And career even more so. And really, under the influence of various sociopolitical events like the world wars, there was a major societal change. So women were able to enter the workplace. What we really see happening in the 19th century is instructive for now because there were claims made about women's ability. Women can't vote because they can't be trusted to make political decisions without making decisions that are reckless. Women can't go to law school because women don't have opinions, so how could they be litigators? How could they engage in arguments? Or they'll be, sort of browbeaten and just cower weeping in a corner if somebody protests something they've said. Women can't go into medicine because that requires science, and science is hard, and, women can't do that. And, of course, in all of these domains, we've seen that women can achieve the highest levels of success. So when the various societal factors like the wars forced women into the workplace or opened up opportunities in education because there weren't enough men, we saw that all the stereotypes have just crumbled. And I think we still live in an age where some of these stereotypes continue to hold women back. Of course, there's been some news items about Obama's cabinet choices in the last day or so. But I think we're also seeing enough role models of women who have achieved at the highest levels to know that these prejudices are just plain false.
But you also hear from women's advocates that women bring something unique to these roles. Is there anything to this argument that men and women think differently?
I think there is, but what we need to think about is the origins of that. So if you have a biological view, women are born to nurture, so therefore they're going to be much more empathetic and much more emotional. I think that's a very dangerous line of argument. First of all, it diminishes our view of the male capacity for empathy, but it also paints women as sort of stuck in this maternal role, which is a very small aspect of women's lives and hopefully a shared aspect if they choose to go that route. So I think what we need to see is that women live in a different culture. They are a different cultural group than men because they're treated differently. And if you see women being raised to play with Barbies, for instance, while men are raised to play with, say trucks or guns, that's going to have an impact on how women think and perceive the world. And when we get to adulthood, we will see differences in how women think as a function of that socialization.
What role can culture play in the emotions we feel? We've had a very cerebral conversation, so I want to end on emotions.
Move to feeling. Well, I wouldn't want to separate feelings from thinking because they're so important for how we make decisions. But I do think that emotions, which look like they're so based on our animal nature, are as amenable to cultural influence as anything else. And you can see that in a number of ways. The actual emotions we have may vary from culture to culture. So, for instance, in the Christian period of Western history, people became very obsessed with an emotion called enthusiasm. We still have the word, but enthusiasm actually meant a kind of powerful emotion you feel when you think you're in the presence of God. And, of course, in a secular society, that kind of emotion, or religious fervor for that matter, no longer have that much relevance. But I think one place where we really see culture-shaping emotions in ways that are interesting and important have to do with emotional disorders. So if you think about disorders like hysteria that were once extremely common in the psychiatric world and are now rarely discussed and diagnosed, or disorders that have become very common like depression, bipolar disorder, maybe ADHD, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder, these things are increasing with every generation. And I think it's not just new diagnoses, though there is some of that. Part of it is that we're training ourselves to be depressed. We're training ourselves to be hyperactive. There are things that are going on culturally here that we don't see in other cultures that are similar to ours economically that are cultivating these forms of psychiatric illness that are related to the emotions.
I've been speaking with philosophy professor Jesse J. Prince about his latest book, Beyond Human Nature, How Culture and Experience Shape the Human Mind. It's published by W.W. Norton and Company. Jesse, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Alicia. Thank you.
Up next, Massimo Montanari talks about how our idea of how we grow, cook, eat, and think about food have changed since the Middle Ages, and how our culture is shaped by our dinner menus. And later on in the show, find out why small changes to your daily routine are more likely to stick than big, sweeping ones. I'm Alicia Menendez, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.